Many of us, whether we participate in religion or not, feel closest to God or the sacred in nature. This is not surprising, as when we trace our lineages back, we find that we all come from ancestors who practiced earth-based spiritualities. We are all indigenous to the earth and co-evolved to have firsthand participation in the life-birthing and love-yearning impulses of our astonishingly generative cosmic perch. To encounter, enjoy, and respond to divine mystery in nature is not a privilege of the few, but the ancient ecological art and vocation of being human. What if, in our climate-changed sixth extinction era of the Anthropocene, a first step towards remending our relationship to nature were simply to step outside, open ourselves to sacred encounter, and vow to live deeply in each season as it passes? What if reshaping our spiritual lives could begin with being startled by a cardinal alighting on a cedar branch, witnessing a river eddy and flow, or being present to the first snowdrops of spring? Where else would sacred presence be but flickering in the momentary encounters of life with life? Through seasonal reflections on embodied spiritual adventures in foraging, fishing, birding, cloud watching, and experimenting with the emergent wild church movement, Live Each Season As It Passes invites a plein air and re-earthed way of being and seeing the world that aims beyond sustainability and towards celebration and praise.
Welcome to The Open Air. This is Jesse Raessler, and you're listening to Open Air Humans, stories about how we can live a happier, healthier, more creative life outdoors. My guest today is author, teacher, and Wild Church pastor, Daniel Cooperrider. Daniel writes at the intersections of theology, spirituality, poetry, climate justice, and spiritual ecology. His first book, Speak with the Earth and It Will Teach You, was awarded the Gold Prize in the 2023 Nautilus Book Awards, Religion and Spirituality of the West. His next book, which is a significant focus of today's discussion, Live Each Season As It Passes, Re-Earthing Spiritual Practice, is forthcoming later in 2025. I hope you enjoy what became a wide-ranging discussion that ventures through theology, seasonality, ritual, and spirituality, recorded on a beautiful spring day right on the water's edge at the Open Air Outpost. Well, Daniel, it's an honor to have you out at the Outpost, and I couldn't imagine a more beautiful day and for a conversation that's going to center a lot on seasons and seasonality. Wow, spring is bursting forth here. I think just in the last few days, like, these leaves are popping from the trees, the ramps are up, there's a chorus of wood frogs and spring peepers every night, the barred owls are talking to each other. It's just a time of year where things come to life. So it seems like a perfect time to be here talking about seasonality and about your writing. So welcome.
Thank you, Jesse. It's absolutely a delight to be here. And we really do have those buzzing, bumptious spring energies blessing us right now as we're talking. So happy to let the birds be part of it too.
Your writing is so alive with how you see divinity in nature. And I wonder, was there, maybe not a specific encounter or instance, but when and where did this all start for you, where you started feeling that presence being in nature?
Well, yeah, from a very young age, it is hard or impossible for me to point to just one moment, but my family, we were fortunate enough to get to spend our whole summers living, you know, outdoor and barefoot on a lake in northern Wisconsin. And our parents just really set us loose. And it was, you know, interacting with frogs and turtles and fishing and canoeing and camping. And it was doing all those things and doing them with our family. And in our family, there was a group of pastors. My grandpa was a Lutheran pastor, as were his three brothers. And their kind of pastoral presence was there too, but they were also the ones who really, really seemed to delight in being being out interacting with the natural world and just kind of that reverence towards God and nature just felt like, you know, two sides of the same coin, like it was just blending. And but you mentioned that word alive, and that's really becoming a key word for me these days, aliveness. And, you know, just to step outside, every time I think about stepping outside these days, I treat it as if when I cross that threshold, I'm almost tripping over a very thin and imperceptible line that's so important, and that's the line between merely being alive and fully feeling alive. And it is in the presence of the more than human world where that is really lured forth from us. And yeah, you mentioned Robin Wall Kimmerer, huge influence on me and so many. You know, I come from a theological and spiritual perspective, and you know, even as a work of botany, you know, I would call that book, you know, the major theological text of the century. And so what I'm really trying to do is, you know, try to absorb and open myself to that influence, which she and others are so generously and urgently sharing for our times. And so from my perspective, that looks like really trying to help evolve and articulate new theologies of nature, ones that move us definitely way beyond that old dominion model of Genesis, but also beyond the, say, stewardship model, which is what I was kind of taught when I was in Div school, which still, you know, privileges the human as being the center holder of value and decision-making. And really the invitation for us now is to articulate and cultivate a theology of nature based on what Kimmerer so finally put a finger on, that relationship and reciprocity with the more than human world. And so that's what I'm passionate about these days. And that's what I'm trying to work on in my own life and with the communities I engage with.
And so you've got, you know, you're writing, this will be your second book, right? Speak with the Earth and It Will Teach You, being the first book, another beautiful, beautiful book. And then the live each season as it passes, which will be forthcoming soon. That's part of what you're doing, right? But you're also engaged in this work in a number of other ways. Can you maybe set the stage of what else you're doing with that?
Well, one of the main ways I'm engaging this in community these days, in spiritual community, is together with my spouse, who's also a pastor, where we've been experimenting with and launching an emergent outdoor-based spiritual community. We're part of the what's called the Wild Church Network, which has been developing you know, a very decentralized kind of community that's responding to this call of our times, the call from the earth to be in relationship with the earth. And so we meet outside. We only meet 8 times a year at the moment, on the solstices and equinoxes, and then the cross-quarter days following the what's known as the Celtic Wheel of the Year. And we're really, you know, I think we all have that experience of taking a hike by ourselves or with a friend or family, and being renewed by our time in nature, recreation. But what might that look like if we could harness those moments, that feeling in community, and let our communities be organized around and with and aligned with the ways of nature and with the seasons? So rather than, you know, say, take a normal liturgy or bulletin that one would use in an indoor church and bring it out to the woods and say you're having your outdoor worship, we are trying to open that concept of liturgy and be mindful of how there's an ongoing liturgy of the landscape, a liturgy of the seasons, and that we are here to link up ourselves with that liturgy, to take our cue first from the bird song and then to add our song, to see what the rooted ones, the trees, are up to, and to try to join in with them in glorifying Creator in the ways that they do. And so it's really speaking to many people's hearts. People share things with me like, I've been longing and praying for a community like this, but didn't know it would it would exist. And it's super kiddo friendly. I've got a 11-month-old and a four-year-old. And they just love Wild Church, and as do many other kiddos. So to try to just summarize what we're trying to do with Wild Church, we, again, a different type of liturgy, liturgy influenced by the landscape and seasons.
Can you actually define liturgy as you're speaking of it, for those that might not be as familiar with that term?
Well, the term technically means the work of the people. And so in a traditional church context, it's when people come together, usually inside a building, and they say their prayers, they read their scriptures, they sing their hymns, and it is often led by an officiant, a priest or pastor. But really, the word itself means work of the whole people, and so it's a participatory action, speaking to some of our deepest human roots. Like there's a theological notion of homo adorans, rather than homo sapien, human the thinker, or the wise one, or homo faber, human the maker. Homo adorans is human the worshiper, human the one who adores and appreciates and marvels at the glory of God, at the glory of the world. And so liturgy is you know, that trying to get to the heart of that work of adoring, of praising, of paying attention. And the Bible has glimmers of this, that, you know, the rivers of the field are singing their praise, and the trees are clapping their hands. And so we're taking that more literally, that the liturgy, the landscape is liturgy, landscape is praise. And so when we gather, we try really to cultivate attunement or reorientation, attunement to who we are, our kinship selves, to where we are. And that's, we do land and landscape acknowledgement, geology acknowledgement, when we are, that's season. And we lead with the phenological season, what's happening in nature. You know, the service berry is blossoming right now, the bud burst happening with so many trees, the hepatica and bloodroot, and the orioles just returning. So we lead with nature, and then we do transition to a bit of reflection on the church calendar, the lectionary. Like, we're in the Eastertide season right now, or we're in Advent, and how might those liturgical calendar moments, what new light might they shine when you re-look at them from the calendar of nature? And it's really not hard to make those connections, you know, winter solstice and Christmas and Easter and the renewal of the earth in spring, Easter itself being tied to both the sun and the moon calendars. And then the final attunement, the good one, the really big one, that big question, why we are, what's our role, what's our particular human gift that we can bring to the world. And with that, rather than like a sermon being the capstone moment of our gathering, we break from the circle. We meet in a circle around a fire. We break from the circle and have what's often called like a wild wander or a saunter, with a little prompt to try to allow ourselves some time to be in that conversant listening, but also speaking with and to receptive mode with the landscape. And then after, say, 20 or so minutes of that, and often when you say 20 minutes, people look at you like, oh my gosh, that's going to feel like forever. What am I going to do for 20 minutes? Like, it's almost impossible actually to get people to come back from just being in that meditative walk with the landscape. And then folks share around the circle, what we call council. And I'm so moved by it, particularly because, you know, it out of doors in the natural world, death is everywhere, and it's right alongside new life. And it's everything is thrown together, and everything is mixing and mingling and busy becoming everything else. And so I have noticed over my couple years of practicing this, that themes of, you know, mortality and healing are core themes that are shared at the end, which is so different. In an indoor setting, we really do seem to want to do our best to scrub death away from the scene. And so from a Christian theological perspective, it's just meeting outside just puts you face to face with the core mysteries of incarnation, death, resurrection, and really gives us that chance not just to talk about God or to hear about God, but to have for ourselves in whatever way or language we might talk about that, the encounter, the feeling, that feeling of awe that we're alive, here we are, the gift of each new day, nature saying yes to life in every moment, and we're part of that. And it just bowls you over with aliveness.
Well, being someone that, you know, grew up, like you had Lutheran pastors, I was raised Lutheran and attending church indoors. I can't wait to experience something like this. I was raised Lutheran and confirmed Lutheran, and I feel like I know it never really touched me at the core in the way that what I've found in the last 5 years, just paying closer attention to nature and seeing the intricate design of things and the interconnections that another guest of the show, Emily Stone, writes so beautifully about, the interconnections. You start seeing these things and you go, wow, it's all around us. Like, if this isn't divinity at work, I don't know what is. And then also, to your point, like the metaphor that you find and go, like, this is happening in nature, what's that got to teach me about my own life? And like seeing that death is required for new life to happen. And there are so many things that I've seen on maybe a small scale in nature that I go, well, wow, that is exactly what's happening on a very different scale, maybe, or what feels like a different scale in my own life. And so that practice, and it has become a practice for me of looking closer and observing, or as Mary Oliver says, look closer, be astonished, tell about it. Mm-hmm. Like, that's hopefully what we're doing a little bit with this podcast. I mean, that's what's shaped my spirituality tremendously in the last 5 years. And so I'm super intrigued by what you're doing. I would love to attend one of those sessions. And in the meantime, your writing has really sparked something for me. And you mentioned, I think, what you can read, or you read the landscape in a way. And that reminded me of something you say or refer to in your first book, Speak with the Earth, and It Will Teach You. You refer to nature as God's first book, right, before the Bible. I was wondering if you could maybe unpack that as an idea a little bit too, because I think there are so many people that in this world that have read the Bible, but I don't know that everybody's looking at nature as a book as well.
Yeah, well, this idea is actually quite ancient in theology, this notion of the two books theory, it's sometimes called. God's the author, or as I like to gloss it too, God is the inspiration or articulator or caller forth of the book of nature and the book of scripture. And for many years, those books were attempted to be read together, both being sources of revelation, both being ways that we can come to know, that creation can come to know Creator. Over the last few hundred years, the concepts have maybe been separated a little bit, and Book of Nature became more taken up by in the realms of science, scientific inquiry. It was a powerful metaphor that Darwin, among others, drew upon. Whereas, you know, maybe post-Reformation, theology has tended more and more to be simply, you know, commentary and conversation about that second book, the book of Scripture. And what I was really trying to do with that first book, and what really excites me these days, is trying to reclaim that notion of the book of nature, and not just in a scientific way that we're not supposed to read the book by dissecting everything and analyzing everything, but we're supposed to read the book in the way that it presents itself to us as beauty, as grief and lament, as joy, you know, the joy of the joy of the cardinal singing, the joy of the red-winged blackbird when it returns in spring. We have thousands of years of amazing, say, biblical interpretation where there's layers upon layers of meaning, the symbolist, the metaphorical, the literal, the historical, the critical. I'm excited about beginning to cultivate that type of hermeneutics, that type of reading of the landscape as that first book of nature.
Wow. That's a concept that I hadn't heard that term. And I think I was, you know, feeling that too. Like, this is where I'm connecting with what I consider the divine out here, not in the four walls of the church. And so when I read that, I was like, that makes so much sense to me. And I'm sure it was, like you said, it's been hundreds of years where the Bible is the book that's been focused on, but you use the word indigenous in your prologue for the new book. And it's an idea that struck me a lot lately too, is like, especially all of us that are transplants to this continent, right? We come from somewhere and we don't think of ourselves as indigenous, but we're all indigenous to somewhere. And whether that's, in my case, Germany, or my wife's case, Sweden, like, I'm so curious, like, what were those earthing practices hundreds and hundreds of years ago before there was the written text that informs so much of it? And that's something I'm so curious and would love to dig more into. And I'm curious if you've studied that at all. You mentioned the Celtic calendar, and there are these things that have the rituals. And like you said, the solstice, oh, that's where Christmas is. And, you know, the Catholic Church came and sort of overlaid some of those seasonal milestones. So I'm curious, like, what in your research you found, or if you have any other thoughts about that.
Yeah, well, Jesse, our ancestors from our families probably knew each other. Mine also come from Scandinavia and Germany, Northern Europe. What I think is really important, it brings us back to Kimmerer again, which is one of the main inspirations for the Wild Church work that I'm up to these days. Near the end of that book, she calls on settler culture to regenerate ceremonies of and for the land. And I had never thought about it like this, but she talks about how those ceremonies of the season of the land no doubt existed in the, say, old world in Northern Europe, but they don't survive emigration very well. What survives transplanting to a new landscape are the more abstract concepts of religion, like doctrine, what you believe, or ethics. You know, in America, we've had a long conversation on the family values being the core kind of spirit religious concept. Those abstract concepts can translate ecosystems, but the particular land-based ones, and she uses that word regenerate, we need to regenerate them here. So in a sense, I am interested in some of the history of what those were, but I think it's also important that we try to listen to the land here and not try to, you know, copy what maybe our indigenous ancestors to Europe did, and certainly not what the indigenous folks here, exactly what their ceremonies, but to using you know, who and what we are for better and worse to create new ritual and ceremony that tries to tie us more closely to landscape and to season. But in our Wild Church, we do try to draw on some of the history. So, for example, we're a week removed from the cross quarter between the spring equinox and the summer solstice, and that's sometimes honored as Beltane or May Day. And we had a gathering that's still filling me with its deliciousness and beauty. We gathered at Winterfell Acres, a small family-run organic farm in the hills south of Madison. And it was a gentle spring rain, and after a long night of harder rain, so the earth was soft, the air was soft. And we had, 40 to 50 folks. It was one of our larger gatherings, and we had a fire going, and somebody brought, in addition to the farm animals there, somebody brought three baby goats recently born, and they were wandering around, and people were scooping them up and cuddling them, and And the kids were, you know, there was a flower crown making station. The kids were all making flower crowns and then running around. At Winterfell Acres, they built a maypole out of a young cottonwood tree and put ribbons around it. And each person grabbed a ribbon on the inner circle and then had an outer circle and, you know, danced around that pole, tying the ribbon to the trunk. And so that was an experience of, you know, maybe reconnecting to what some ancestors did.
Ritual is something that I think we've lost a lot of in our modern world too. And, you know, reconnecting with that side, you know, we've recently started attending the Lutheran church, and more than anything, it was about just community and ritual and actually like feelings of spirituality. I still get more about here, right? When I come out here, when the boys and I go on a hike, or when we hear the spring peepers for the first time in the spring, that's resurrection right there. But now it's so interesting to find some of those old rituals and think about what they meant and what they mean. And it reminds me another big part, I think, of your new book, which is categorized by, you have 13 essays, right, that are each a different lunar cycle. And I have a children's book about that I was sharing with the boys, about like what each moon is, and the hunter moon and the pink moon and the strawberry moon and all the moons. And I think there's something about reorienting how you note the passage of time to be more about that, the natural world and seasonality, than about the Gregorian calendar, that really changes your whole mindset. You know, it's like the language you use can change your mindset. The way you note the passing of time can change your mindset. And I'm wondering if you wanted to talk a little bit about why that's such an anchoring piece of this new book for you and what that means. Mm.
Well, the seasons have had such a profound influence on the arts, like poetry and music and painting. But at least in my study of it, they've hardly had much of an influence on, say, theology or philosophy. We tend to engage in that type of thinking as if we're dealing with, you know, abstract ideas that, you know, drop out of the sky and mean the same thing today as they did yesterday. But the world itself, the landscape, you know, is constantly changing and renewing, and its truth is not abstract, universal. It's particular, local. Medieval theologian Duns Scotus called it the haes seitas. I don't know if I'm saying that Latin right, but it's the radical thisness of things that, you know, there's no two hepatica that are exactly the same. It's this hepatica. And as a turkey vulture flies over us, there's no two turkey vultures. They each have their own way of teetering in the sky. So what seasons do for me, paying attention to the seasons, is a way of just being present to the moment, present to what's happening. And again, it leads to that experience of aliveness, which I think is what I know I'm longing for, and I sense we're all longing for that enlivenment, that aliveness. And so seasons bring us there. Season comes from a French and Latin word, satio, which means to sow. So it directly links season to action, to something happening, and particularly to it happening at the right time or when it's supposed to happen. And so season invites us to experience ourselves along with the landscape in the deeper truth that is always the case, which is that we are a part of all of this. There's no way we could not be. We might kind of trick ourselves into thinking that we're above or beyond this, but we're not, and how wonderful that we're not, how gracious that we're enmeshed with all of this.
You're saying with seasonality, when you start paying attention to that, how does that change your mindset?
Well, again, it keys you into that life and death and new life power that's always the case. You know, we tend to think of fall as a season of ending, maybe a season of death. But even in spring, there can be that feeling, particularly maybe when the blossoms that are bursting right now, their petals start to drop, In Japan, they have a tradition of gathering under the blossoming cherry trees for a picnic to read poetry and have a little party called hanami, really just celebrating the beautiful but briefness, the beautiful brevity of life.
Hold on, it's a poetry party? Oh my gosh, we need one of those over here. Why aren't there more poetry parties? Oh my goodness, that sounds so lovely.
Absolutely, it is really lovely. My family, we try to do a little picnic every year around this time of year beneath the flowering tree. The seasons just, they make us not forget how interesting everything is that is happening, and how interesting it is that tomorrow it'll be new, and there will be new invitations on the landscape, and there will be new new feelings in the air. The clouds will have different moods. The air, the atmosphere will have a different mood. And so really, you know, there's been a lot of good thinking and research recently that's kind of reviving and reclaiming the Gaia hypothesis, that the Earth, you know, the Earth is alive in its way, in its Earth way. And so the seasons are sort of the aliveness of the Earth, and it's in the moment expression. And so if we turn away from the seasons, in a sense we're turning away from the Earth. But then when we turn back towards the seasons, we're turning back towards the Earth and remembering ourselves as Earth, which is really important theological concept for me. I've been thinking about it as radical Earth empathy, that particularly in our times of climate unraveling, you know, we need to feel things deeply. It's so easy to become numbed, and we really need to risk feeling deeply. And so that goes with, you know, maybe the climate fear and anxiety we feel is the same that the trees feel as the wildfires approach. The loneliness we feel, species loneliness, is maybe something of the loneliness of the white rhino facing extinction, and the many other species facing extinction, each one taking a little spark of the glory of God with them. But then so too, the joy we feel is the joy of these panfish that just all of a sudden surfaced, creating these expanding rings across the lake. Maybe they were a bug hatch that they were all very excited about. The joy we feel is the joy of the brown thrasher. I was listening to one yesterday. It sounds like 20 birds singing at once, one brown thrasher. And then I start to marvel at there's evolutionary theories that suggest that humans learned speech and song, you know, in a biomimetic way from the birds. A lot of our other mammal relatives don't vocalize as much as we do. They use more gestures. But our speaking, and especially our singing, is avian, is bird-like. So just to think, you know, where did we learn to swim from? Where did we learn to stand up straight from? You know, we're constantly in this co-evolution and biomimetic feedback with the more than human world, and that's why we are who we are, and that's what's tuned these incredible instruments of our bodies over the course of generations and generations.
He used the word marvel, and earlier he used the word awe, and I think for me that's where you learn something like that, or maybe you see something in nature, you see the interconnection, and just how a flower shapes itself. I think Emily writes about the Dutchman's breeches and how that's a form of communication with a certain insect, or you read about how trees are actually sending each other nutrients underground to the mycelium network, and they're communicating and they're social and they care for each other, and you just go like, wow, it is marveling and it is awe. And for me, that's what taps into something much more profound than what's just on the surface. But when you start to look closer, you do get that sense of awe. And then for me, it leads to gratitude. And from gratitude, it goes to, wow, we are not apart from this. We are a part of this. And I want to protect that, because especially you brought up Gaia, like these interconnections don't stop with just the few that we know about. They're everywhere, and they're working on different levels that maybe aren't visible to us, or we don't fully comprehend yet. But they're there, and the more that you find and the more you learn about, it's like, wow, we have to protect all of this. And I'm curious, it seems like that's at the core of a lot of your work is reintroducing people to those sorts of marvels. And I'm curious if you have maybe any some parting ideas for folks that, like, what's the most accessible way to start reorienting your thinking or just like your mindset to paying closer attention?
Yeah, well, you mentioned how we've long known intellectually about, you know, the interdependence of things, that kind of ecological insight from folks like Aldo Leopold. But I think what we need more and more these days is not just to hear, you know, an argument that says everything is interconnected, so let's treat it better. But we really need invitations and articulations that help us really feel and live into that inner being, that interconnection. And so with my writing, rather than trying to argue, I am trying to more evoke, or maybe try to just help folks start to put that language to what they might be hearing or feeling or tasting or touching. Because we need to feel into it and live into it with our whole embodied beings. And I would say, just very, very practically, it's there's so many good. We live, first of all, we live in an age where anyone can become an amateur naturalist. We have these amazing tools at our disposal to, you know, that will help us listen and identify the bird songs, or identify the plants emerging, or identify the fungi, or identify the frogs, the frog chorus. So really the only barrier is our curiosity. If you hear a bird and you really want to learn more and deepen your relationship with this being, with this species, you know, you can learn who the bird is and learn their song. And so just to begin by embracing that curiosity, that you know, what asking yourselves when you wake up, like, what's happening today? What is all this? Like, what? This is amazing. Let's get out there and be a part of it. And that too, the kind of be a part of it notion has become so important to me. In my book, I'm trying to maybe convene a little conversation around a concept that I'm calling re-earthing, which for me, I mostly mean like what folks tend to mean by rewilding. But that concept comes from kind of ecological restoration, that kind of suggests, you know, nature, let's remove the human presence from the landscape. Nature can do its thing over there. We'll do our thing over here, and all will be well. But what's more exciting for me these days is not moving even further away from nature and reinforcing that sense of separateness, human nature, but to really getting out there and getting in there and, you know, experiencing yourselves as part and participant with it all. So maybe that is through cultivating your own practice of foraging, even just learning one plant and being in relationship with that plant. Or maybe it's birding or cloud watching or just walking or hiking, or cultivate those little daily practices that get us out the door and get us interacting with the landscape, because it's the landscape which is the great teacher. The other day we went to a a very special ramp spot for our family. And right when I opened the door, I heard the oven bird, which their call is sometimes transcribed as resounding, getting louder and louder, saying, "Teacher, teacher, teacher." And then I was just sitting there like, huh, well, who is the teacher? It's the bird, yeah, and it's the white pines, and it's the stream that the ramps grow along. And, you know, this, by getting out of the car and just into the woods, you know, I'm going to school. That is teacher. That is guru. That is rabbi.
To learn more about Daniel, his books, or Flickr Wild Church, visit danielcooperwriter.com. That's DanielCooperwriter.com. This episode is brought to you by the Open Air Outpost, a new nature escape with luxury tiny cabin and glamping options just 2 hours northeast of the Twin Cities. It's a place where we made it easy to put into practice all the wisdom we've learned from the guests on this very show. You can even book unique experiences with some of them as part of your stay. Learn more at openairoutpost.com. Before I go, I wanted to say thank you for tuning in after a fairly significant absence of new episodes. We hope to record additional discussions in the not-too-distant future, and we'll release those as those discussions happen. Until then, we invite you to take Mary Oliver's advice, which feels like a bit of a tonic for our current times. That is, look closer, be astonished, and tell about it. Thanks for spending your time with us and sharing your life with us. Out here, in the open air.